From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. Tomorrow is Thanksgiving, when millions of families across the country will gather under one roof. It's a centuries-old tradition of spending time together, and a stark contrast to how many Americans usually connect with each other through social media. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram might be connecting us, but in troubling ways, they're also ripping us apart. They amplify outrage, build factionalism, and often override wisdom and the truth. This hour on Point, the rise of social media and the threat to democracy and what can be done to right the ship. Join us. What role does social media play in your life? How has it affected your local community? Are you worried that that like button on Facebook promotes fake news at the expense of reason and truth? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook and On Point Radio. Joining us now from New York is Jonathan Haidt, social psychologist and professor of ethical leadership at NYU's Stern School of Business. His article in the December issue of The Atlantic magazine is entitled "The Dark Psychology of Social Networks: Why It Feels Like Everything Is Going Haywire." You can find a link to that piece at our website, onpointradio.org. John Haidt, welcome to On Point. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for this excellent story.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for giving me a chance to talk about the thing I've been thinking about nonstop for the last few years.
Well, early on in your excellent piece in The Atlantic, you talk about James Madison, which I just loved. I loved it that you brought it back to sort of our founding fathers and his fear of factionalism that could, quote, inflame men with mutual animosity. So how did Madison view this threat to democracy, and how did he imagine that the Constitution of this country would deal with it?
Yes. The Federalist 10 is one of the most brilliant pieces of writing, both about political psychology and about the design of government. And it's really worth going back and reading it. And actually, I'd love to just read a few short quotes.
Please.
Because you have to put yourself back in the mindset of the founders. And you know, here they are drafting the Constitution. They know that democracy has had a pretty bad history. It tends to be unstable. It tends not to last. And they're trying to design a system that will overcome the known principal defect of democracy, which according to Madison is faction or factionalism. And he writes just brilliantly about what happens to people when you put them in a group and they have to work things out. And he talks about – so he has this great phrase. He says – here he's speaking about direct democracies. He says, "Such democracies have ever been spectacles of turbulence and contention and have in general been as short in their lives as they have been violent in their deaths." So Madison and the other founders wanted to make sure we don't want to create a direct democracy where the people get to vote on everything. We have to build in all kinds of mechanisms that will slow things down, cool things down, let cooler heads prevail, give space for reason to come in. And so that's the first piece, is they understood the psychology of faction or tribalism, we might say today. But then the other big piece, which is most relevant, and this is really the kickoff for the whole article, is there's a section of Federalist 10 where Madison is musing on how small groups are usually better, usually more functional. But when it comes to politics, a very large country might be more stable because if someone starts a fire in one place, it won't spread. And here, I'll read the exact quote. He says, "Here again, the extent of the union," meaning the vast size of those original colonies or states by then, "the extent of the union gives it the most palpable advantage. The influence of factious leaders may kindle a flame within their particular states, but will be unable to spread a general conflagration through the other states," you know, because, I mean, it's just so big. And by the time news gets from New Hampshire to Georgia, I mean, that's going to be weeks.
Yeah, I love that idea.
Yeah.
But of course, that was centuries before the advent of social media. Now you can start a fire in New
exactly.
Hampshire, and it will burn just as brightly in Georgia almost instantaneously. That's
exactly.
Really what we're dealing with now with social media, right?
That's exactly it. That's the central point, or that's the jumping off point of our article. And I should point out that this is co-written with Tobias Rose Stockwell, who actually understands social media really well from the inside. I'm a social psychologist. I do the politics and psychology, but I'm not an expert on social media. But when we came together and worked on this article, I think we figured out the key moment or the key two-year period where things changed and where Madison's fears became realized.
So in this article, you and Tobias ask, what if this technology increased the amount of mutual animosity and the speed at which outrage spread? And in fact, that's exactly what's happened. So what's the effect of that?
My own research is on moral psychology and political psychology and how we create moral matrices, like the movie The Matrix. We create these consensual hallucinations and we live in them. And as long as we kind of all share some sort of national sense of who we are or what has happened, and we can argue about things within it, and we can create all kinds of sub-matrices within that. But what social media allowed us to do is to manufacture these little bubbles, these little moral matrices or little subcultures in a matter of hours. And once we're all caught up in these little worlds that are organized in hatred of other worlds, then we get Madison's nightmare, just endless factionalism, endless fighting, and really no way of establishing common shared facts.
Wow. Yeah, you describe I think you almost put it in these terms, a sort of moral outrage industry. I mean, social media having the ability to constantly express anger, and it's public performance that is rated, by numbers of clicks and numbers of shares as opposed to the value to society.
Exactly. So that's the key thing that social media did to us. Because first, before social media, we were pretty well connected. I mean, the telephone and radio and television and email, all of those things allowed us to spread news instantly. But yet things didn't blow up in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. I mean, there was obviously a period of conflict in the late 60s. But social media changes things fundamentally for this reason. What we all have to do, and I didn't realize this until I worked with Tobias, go back to the early days of social media when it was MySpace and Friendster and the Facebook, in which people would put up these posts that basically said, look at me. Here are the bands that I like. And here are all the friends that I have. And there was no way to spread outrage. And that's true through 2006 when Facebook opens to the public. In 2008, Facebook begins to dominate and really rise very quickly. But it isn't really until 2009 that the nature of the connectivity changes. And this is key. It's not simple connectivity which is the problem. It's the new kind of connectivity. And it changes in two ways. So the first is that Twitter puts on the retweet button. And that allows posts, especially angry posts, posts that get engagement, posts that make people press retweet. Twitter's retweet button is a huge part of the story because now everybody can spread anger instantly. And of course, it can increase exponentially by people's retweet networks. And the other big thing is that Facebook puts on the like button, which gives it huge amounts of information about what people like, which allows them to then algorithmicize or use algorithms to order the news feed. I mean, they'd begun that earlier, but it really takes off in around 2010, 2011. And so it's not just connectivity, it's performative connectivity. There's a big element of performance. And then the story is complete, or the loop really closes, once it becomes so engaging that people aren't going to the news sites very much anymore. They're getting their news from social media, and now the mainstream news sources have to adapt to that. So they have to start being more clickbaity. They have to start headline testing. And you get once the news media adapts to the social media world, now we have what we call in the article the outrage machine. By 2013, America has built an extraordinarily effective outrage machine that anyone in the world can use to spread hatred, distrust, and falsehoods. And sure enough, the Russians they've been messing with our democracy for decades. But the Russians see it, they jump on it, and they use it extremely well.
Boy, you talk about what this means to the impact that it has on reason and truth. You have a section entitled The Decline of Wisdom. Expand on that. So we get it that this has created this outrage machine. What's this terrible effect it has on wisdom, essentially?
Yeah. So there's two things. First, let's appreciate. I think if we here's one resolution I'd like to make for the country as a social scientist. It's really, really hard to find the truth. It always has been. We all suffer from confirmation bias. Mm-hmm. We all find reasons to believe whatever we want to believe. That has always been true. Okay, so now you bring in the internet and Google, which are wonderful things, but boy, do they help us find evidence to believe whatever we want. And so conspiracy theories spread back beginning in the 90s. It supercharges that. Well, then social media comes in, and now it supercharges it yet again. So it's always hard to find the truth, and now sometimes it's almost impossible. The truth is there. I'm not a relativist. I'm a social psychologist who recognizes that one of the miracles of late 20th century liberal democracy was that we had institutions such as universities and newspapers and court systems that had evolved pretty good means of finding the truth, and now all of those are at least threatened, or they're working less well because of social media. So that's the systemic part of it.
Yeah, boy. You write as well, as we move toward the break, we've got about 30 seconds left, but I want to ask you, you write as well that this all has a particularly profound effect on younger generations. Explain that.
Absolutely. So I first began noticing this problem. I mean, basically the origin of this Atlantic essay is that I began seeing strange things happening on college campuses around 2014, 2015. My friend Greg Lukianoff first noticed this, and together we wrote an article called The Coddling of the American Mind. So we began to notice that college students arriving in 2014 were more depressed, anxious, fragile. They were just very different from anything we'd ever seen. And at first we thought that colleges were somehow doing this to their students. But after the article came out, we realized, no, actually, there's a gigantic generational shift. Gen Z, kids born in 1996 or later, are really different from the millennials or anything before. And I hope and expect that's what we'll talk about once Sherry Turkle joins us.
That's right. Sherry Turkle is going to be joining us in the next break. Listeners, we're talking after the next break. We're talking to Jonathan Haidt about his very compelling piece in The Atlantic, The Dark Psychology of Social Networks. You can find it at onpointradio.org. What do you think? We're discussing the impact of social media. Do you buy John's argument that it is hurting, threatening our democracy? I'm Anthony Brooks. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're discussing the influence of social media and what its rising impact means for both the individual and the country as a whole. You can join the conversation. What changes or regulations do you want to see enacted to curb the potentially dangerous consequences of social media? Are we being taken over by social media or cell phones and apps? What keeps us coming back for more? Find us on Twitter and on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm joined by Jonathan Haidt, a social psychologist and professor at NYU's Stern School of Business. His article in the December issue of The Atlantic magazine is entitled The Dark Psychology of Social Networks. And also with me here in the studio in Boston is Sherry Turkle. She's professor of the Social Studies of Science and Technology at Harvard. She's the founding director of the MIT Initiative on Technology and Self and author of the 2015 New York Times bestseller, Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age. Sherry Turkle, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
Lovely to be here. I'm professor at MIT. My colleagues at MIT will be quite upset if...
Did I say Harvard?
You did.
I'm so sorry because I'm staring at a script and it says clearly as clear as day, MIT.
I never correct anybody.
No,
I just had to.
You're absolutely within your right. And I'm glad you did. did, and forgive the forgive that mistake.
I'm so proud.
As you should be. So we've been, you've been exploring the effects of the digital world on human behavior and our culture and our lives. What do you hear in Jonathan Haidt's case about social media as threatening democracy?
Well, you know, I'm reminded when I read Jonathan's latest work of a story from my own life. I lived with my grandparents in Brooklyn from when I was 2 to when I was around 8. And every morning she took me down to the mailboxes and she pointed to the mailboxes. She was from an Eastern European background. And she said, look at those mailboxes. In the United States, it's a federal offense for anybody to read your mail. A federal offense. That's why we're in America. Your mail is private. Democracy and privacy, that's why we're in America. And I remember as my daughter was growing up, knowing that Gmail was basically scraping, you know, her mail, my mail, that the notions of privacy, intimacy, democracy, in my mind, which are so linked, for her generation, how would I explain to her the importance of the linkage of democracy, privacy, and intimacy? And I think that what we see in, I think in what Jonathan is pointing out, is that old linkages from history, from reading history, from knowing history, for a generation that just grows up with a technology that it describes as their luxuries, to have these free email, to have this, to have that, where they're not thinking about, is it private? Is it mine? Am I the product rather than the consumer? It's very hard to explain to them without a new kind of pedagogy, a new kind of teaching, that technology, as I put it, makes us forget what we know about life. It makes us forget what we know about politics and history. And we have to retrain ourselves to see what's important.
And I want to talk about how we retrain ourselves. But John Haidt, does that sound right? I mean, that seems to be coupled beautifully with what you were talking about in this article, the sort of the erosion of wisdom, essentially.
Yeah. Oh, it absolutely is. I've met Sherry only once. I was at the TED conference in 2012 when she gave this really powerful talk on Alone Together, on how we are, the more we are connected, the less intimacy we have. And she's got this amazing line in there, I think it was there, where she says, we are forever elsewhere. Now that we have these devices, we are forever elsewhere. We're not really connecting to the people that we're physically with. And I think what you have to see, or I think what I think a way to think about this, to really understand just how profound the change is for Gen Z, for young people, along the lines of what of Sherry's story with her grandmother, is think about all the information coming into a person's eyes and ears. Think about this giant river of information coming in. And of course, there's more coming in now than there was 100 years ago. But where is it from? And you know, if we go back 100 years, some portion of it was old classics, Bible, Shakespeare. Some portion of it was maybe 10 or 20 years old, and some portion of it was created just very recently. But as we go into the late 20th century, it shifts. And when I grew up in the 70s, we watched a lot of television. But a lot of that television was made by people who – all of it was made by people who are older than me, and it was often from several decades previously. So there's a shift towards the present, but we're still very much in touch with at least one or two generations behind us. And now when I look at my kids who are 10 and 13, and we look at young people today who are immersed in information, memes, songs, ideas that were created within the last few weeks. Now, it's true that kids these days watch The Office, so they are familiar with how things were 5 or 10 years ago. But as far as I can tell, they have almost no contact with anything from the 20th century or before. Mm. And I think this ultimately means – in a sense, we're cutting – or it's a generation that may be cut off from all that we've learned the hard way about living together, about democracy, about happiness. So when Sherry talks about how technology makes us forget what we know, I think she's exactly right.
I would also have to say that it's not just that we're cut off from history, is that our attention – I teach in a university and I teach some of the best students in the world. And I used to assign a book a week, and students would happily say, a book a week in a class, that's about right. A book a week now feels like abuse.
Wow.
It's a book. You know, it's no longer the unit. It's no longer kind of the appropriate unit because people really are used to reading in kind of mind-sized bites on the internet. And people's attention by reading hypertext, by reading linkages, really has been reduced. So I would add to Jonathan's point about, you know, when the information is coming from, a sense that and I have many colleagues who argue very poetically for how wonderful it is to surf and link a lot of little bits of information. But I really feel that you need the long form to make a case that really teaches you how to think complexly about a matter. A book is a very important kind of object. And one of the things we need to do to understand the kinds of complexity that we face is to retrain our minds to read something like a book. So it isn't just that we have to read the old. We have to read the long. And I think those two things need to sort of dovetail. It isn't just a question of history.
So, listeners, there's one of the challenges, and I want to get the listeners into this conversation because we've got a lot of them wanting to do so. Listeners, we're talking about the effect of social media. We're focusing on a wonderful piece by John Haidt in the December issue of the Atlantic magazine. You can find we've posted a version of it on our website, onpointradio.org. It's called The Dark Psychology of Social Networks. In the studio with me is Sherry Turkle from MIT. Martin is calling from Savannah, Georgia. Martin, go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks so much.
Hi. Thanks for letting me on the air. And I just want you to know, I'm listening to your conversation while I'm doing other things. And that gives a certain gestalt. And what I hear are very intellectual people at a great distance from your subject. And I also hear that your concepts are very intricate and, again, very remote from the topic. And as I was listening, I was thinking about Eric Hoffer from the early 60s, the philosopher longshoreman, who said, "There is no greater threat to democracy than unemployed scribes." And, you know, our society doesn't have unemployed scribes, but we have underemployed scribes who have too much time for too much complexity. And what's happened with these media is a very wonderful thing that you seem totally oblivious to. It is fantastic that people can voice their opinion now as openly and freely as they do. And the dark side of it, I mean, this comical idea that there is something sinister about it is simply the left.
Well, Martin, we take your point, and I want to put it to our guests. Jonathan Haidt, what do you think? There's no dark side to this. This is just about freedom of expression.
Yeah. Well, first, obviously, there are pluses and minuses to everything that was true for automobiles, fast food, guns, you name it. There are upsides and downsides. And it is certainly true that over time, we tend to find ways to adapt, so things are likely to get better. But if Martin is saying we should be celebrating that people can speak, well, you know what? With email and blogs and the internet, they already had that. We're not saying, oh, finally people got a voice in 2009 or 2011. People have had a voice via technology for quite a while. It's a very different way of connecting people that brings out not their authentic voice, but their moral grandstanding, their tribal or pylon behavior that they're often ashamed of. So I think if we focus on social media versus the rest of the internet, then I think we can see that there's much more downside to social media, whereas the internet, I do think, is overwhelmingly upside. Now, as to his claim that Sherry and I are distant from our subjects, Sherry and I both teach at universities. We spend a lot of time with young people. Sherry's whole method of work is to interview hundreds and hundreds of people. So I think we are not divorced. We are not just sitting back and reading books on top of the Acropolis. We're out there collecting data, talking with people, and listening.
Sherry Turkle, I'd love you to respond to the caller as well.
I, I think what I would say to this gentleman is that I've characterized a new state of mind, a new state of self in this kind of social media world that I call I share, therefore I am. It's kind of a play on I think, therefore I am. And before, people would say, I have a feeling, I want to make a call. Now people say, I want to have a feeling, I need to send a text. I want to have a feeling, I need to post on Facebook. And the difference might seem subtle, but the point that I get from really a lot of being in there with young people is that you're not you and you don't form an opinion unless you are sharing, unless you're performing, unless you think you're being watched. And your opinion and the way you express it is shaped by what you think will be pleasing to that audience. And that switch is, I think, where Jonathan and I come together in trying to say, hey, let's look at that movement and let's think about what that does for democracy. Because one of the thinkers I think about in kind of at the time of the revolution is actually pre-revolutionary, is Joseph Addison, who loved the English coffee houses as a place to go and talk. You thought it was a cradle of democracy. And he used to say he would go to these coffee houses and only talk to the people he disagreed with. Mm-hmm. And that for him was the miracle of the coffee houses. And those conversations, spontaneous, what he liked in his writing, he talks about liking to look like a fool and liking they looked like a fool because they would be disagreeing with each other. Those are the kinds of conversations where things did calm down and people did understand each other and offer each other the possibility of empathic understanding that led to democracy in his view. You don't get that if you're sitting around thinking, how can I present myself in a way that will be showy or pleasing or provocative? So I think that's where we're seeing the problem. It isn't in self-expression. It's in a self-expression for a certain kind of performative purpose.
So Jonathan Haidt, though, one of my questions, sort of big questions about this and what you wrote is, does it feel like we're facing a losing battle? That is, the horses seem to be out of the barn now, galloping away. I'm not sure how you get them back in.
Mm-hmm. It certainly feels like we're facing a losing battle. And whenever I get very pessimistic, as I am these days, I always just think of Steven Pinker, the professor at Harvard, a psychologist, who's been writing books about how in the long run everything's getting better and the pessimists have always been wrong. And one of the main reasons they're wrong is that people are actually creative and adaptable and they tend to find solutions for problems. And so I think Sherry and I both would, and I know there's a strand of optimism in Sherry's work, I think we're both optimistic that if we can figure out what's happening to us, we can make changes to social media, we can make changes to our behavior. So it's a gigantic task, especially with a completely dysfunctional politics and a raging culture war. But no, I think as academics, we think that if we understand a problem, there are ways to address it.
Let's take another call. Paula is calling from Boston. Paula, go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks so much for the call.
Thank you. I really want to take this opportunity to point out Sacha Baron Cohen's speech at his ADL Leadership Award. Those 20 minutes, I suggest for everyone listening to really take the moment to look up. He really talks about how social media needs to be regulated like any other source of media, the news, movies. Through his whole comedy career, he has pointed out how people genuinely believe their implicit bias, and he does such a phenomenal job in highlighting how social media and false news makes it so that people don't believe facts. They believe the loudest, most popular, however it was spread on their Facebook timeline because they believe it's closer to them.
Paula, I'm really glad you brought this up. And in fact, we're going to play a clip from Baron Cohen, from Sacha Baron Cohen. Here he is last week in prepared remarks to the Anti-Defamation League. He took aim at social networks and streaming technology services. Here he is.
The algorithms these platforms depend on deliberately amplify the type of content that keeps users engaged. Stories that appeal to our baser instincts and that trigger outrage and fear. It's why YouTube recommended videos by the conspiracist Alex Jones billions of times. It's why fake news outperforms real news, because studies show that lies spread faster than truth.
That was Sacha Baron Cohen last week in prepared remarks to the Anti-Defamation League. We are talking about the wide reach of social media on society and ourselves. You can join the conversation. How has your social media use changed in recent years? I'm joined by Jonathan Haidt and Sherry Turkle. We're going to come back with more of your calls, and we're going to talk a little bit about possibilities about where to go next. In other words, how do we write this ship? Can we write this ship? I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're discussing social media use, what it's doing to us, to the country, to democracy. With us is Jonathan Haidt, social psychologist and professor at NYU Stern School of Business. His article in the December issue of The Atlantic magazine is entitled The Dark Psychology of Social Networks. Also here in the studio is Sherry Turkle, professor of the Social Studies of Science and Technology at MIT. John Haidt, I want to come back to you and ask you about the link between the use of social media and depression.
Yes, that's the other big piece of this. If we're going to be talking about regulating social media, we have to have a clear case that there are harms. And showing the harms on democracy, which we're talking about, are tricky, but that is one reason to regulate it. But the other big reason is that we have a gigantic increase in rates of depression, anxiety, self-harm, and suicide that begins right around 2012. It happens in multiple countries at the same time. I've been collecting data studies from the US, UK, Canada. We see it in Australia, New Zealand. And it just takes off right around 2012, plus or minus a year or two. And it hits girls much more than boys. And it hits preteen girls especially hard. Mm. Now, there is no other way to explain this, this pattern across countries. I mean, the global financial crisis doesn't explain it. It doesn't explain why preteen girls are the ones who are getting so depressed. And so this key period that we're talking about, 2009 to 2012, when social media changes, it becomes much more addictive and much more outrage prone. And as Sherry was talking about, it encourages much more performance. And so this really affects especially teen girls who are much more subject to external beauty standards and competition and different forms of aggression against relationships. So we do have an epidemic of depression, anxiety. It's really hitting Gen Z hard. It's really damaging so many people in that generation. There's enormous suffering. I have a literature review. If listeners go to thecoddling.com and then under Solutions, Better Mental Health, I've been reviewing all the evidence there. And while there are contradictory studies, the correlational and experimental studies are pointing to a strong relationship. So that's the other thing we need to put on the table here. This isn't just a bunch of, you know, old people saying, oh, it was better in our day. Something is going really, really wrong for Gen Z, and we've got to figure out what.
Really important stuff. Sherry Turkle, I want to come back to you because it seems like the challenge here, I completely buy Jonathan Haidt's concern about social media and what it's doing, but it begins with this device.
Yes, it does.
And the allure of this device, and we all understand that. We're all subject to it. I think we all sort of struggle with trying to put that device down. What's going on? What explains this extraordinary allure?
It's really about our vulnerability to what this device offers us. You can be a loner, but not really alone. You don't have to have the vulnerability of what's at stake in a conversation, where you have to put yourself out there and potentially get hurt, which is what conversation is about. I once asked somebody what was so terrible about conversation. This was an 18-year-old who told me he preferred to do everything by text. And he said, well, you have to – you don't know what you're going to say next. They don't know – you have to – they don't know – you don't – they could say anything and you don't know – I mean, he described the most banal thing. And I was like waiting for the – you know, I was like waiting for the – But really he was describing the painfulness of an empathic experience where the author of empathy is really to feel what somebody else is feeling and stay with it.
Yeah.
And he was just, the vulnerability of that was terrible. But the bottom line is that with a device, you can avoid boredom and solitude.
Right.
And boredom and solitude are developmental challenges that if you get them right, you can develop as a person, you can develop empathy, you can develop the capacity to be alone, which means you can develop the capacity to really have a relationship with someone else. Because if you can't be alone with yourself, you can't know yourself well enough to really offer that self to someone else and get to know them and have mutuality. And that is hard, but that is essential to mature adult relationships. And there's a great line from the psychoanalytic tradition: if you don't teach your children to be alone, you'll only teach them how to be lonely.
Oh, boy. That's profound, isn't it?
And that is profound. Mm. And that is what we are doing with these devices, because we're only teaching our children how to be lonely, because every time they need a little bit of stimulation, they don't turn to another person. They pick up a screen.
Mm.
And so we have potty trainers with a slot for an iPhone or a slot for an iPad. We have baby bouncers with a slot for a device. And these devices keep us from really having to face the challenges of being a person.
Let's go to Bryce, who's calling from Lansing, Michigan. Bryce, you're on the air. Thanks so much for the call. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. So I guess what I wanted to say was I have really been aware of this political factionism. And as somebody who works in politics and I got my degree in political science, I'm really aware of that. However, I just recently deleted my Twitter account because it wasn't the factionalism. It was that I couldn't have substantial political debate on that platform because it's either 240 character limit or, you know, you can put a long message on Facebook. However, that always gets shortened up. So people are having these political debates in 240 characters or less and not having this thoughtful conversation that's required for political discourse. And that's my comment. And, you know, thank you so much for taking my call.
Bryce, thanks a lot. John Haidt, what did you hear there? I mean, that's pretty much consistent with what you're talking about, isn't it?
Well, yes. And certainly the limits that make it harder to have a deep conversation or explore ideas. But I would say, as a social psychologist, I'd say it's not the technical limits, it's the social limits. And so in the story that Sherry told about Addison going to coffee shops. He was talking face to face with people who lived in the same town. I suppose it was London. And when you have ties, when you have you know the person's identity, and you're tied together, and you have friends in common, you can't be too cruel. Whereas on social media, you can be anonymous. And, you know, as we know, when you give people a mask of anonymity, even good people can do nasty, nasty things. So if our public square, if Twitter, you know, if the goal was to create public conversations and foster public conversations, well, that would be great if they were conversations like the coffee shop. But if it's basically a public square at night where everybody wears a mask and can carry whatever weapons they want and there's no police force and no hospitals, who would want to go to that public square?
Mm. So, John, what is the solution here? You have a section of your excellent piece that asks the question, is there any way back? And you offer some proposals.
Yeah. I mean, there are a number of things we can do which might add up. For one thing, to the fact that our performance, our words are not they're not expressing what we really feel and think in many cases. In many cases, we're playing to the audience. And so I think Instagram has at least going in the right direction with its recent moves. They're testing out hiding the like counter. Now, you still like crazy, so you're still liking everybody and everything. But at least you're not humiliated when your own posts don't get a lot of likes. So it's a small step, but at least it's reducing this grandstand or the display and the constant judging based on metrics. So there are things we can do there. I think the most important single thing that we could do is realize that we're no longer in an age the harms are clear enough to democracy that we can't just let anyone create an account at any time without showing any identification or verification. So I'm not saying you should have to show your driver's license to Facebook. I don't know that I would trust them with that information, even though I guess they probably already know everything about it. But there has to be a way where to get an account, you have to prove that you're a real person to somebody. It might be a nonprofit agency set up for the purpose, as and there are several of those around the internet. But that would immediately cut way back on the trolling. There are lots of people who make death threats, rape threats, who do all kinds of horrible things because there's no way anyone can find out who they are. I think we must go to a system of verification, and only then, if people have to show something that shows their age, that is the only way we'll ever be able to keep kids off before the age of 13. My daughter is in fifth grade. All the girls are getting Instagram, and they're likely to have higher rates of depression going into middle school. There's no way to stop this unless we have some sort of age verification. I think that's something we'll have to do. And then finally, the third thing we talk about in our article is there has to be some accountability for the algorithms, as Baron Cohen was talking about. Algorithms that optimize for engagement, you know, we can understand the business reason for doing that, but they have to at least be open enough, or the team that makes them should be at least in discussion with outside people so that we can have some public accountability for these algorithms that are governing our public life and a lot of our news media consumption.
Sherry, I'd love to get your comments on that. I mean, my question is, you know, we're talking about corporations that make billions of dollars off of these habits. Are they going to go along with these, you know, what to me sound like reasonable suggestions?
Well, you know, I think the nature of these corporations, I think we have to look again. You know, I like to say that we think the internet is all grown up because we grew up with the internet. But it's not. It's a baby internet. Mm. These are baby companies. We have to take some kind of longer view. It's not like Facebook is a mature company and it sort of is what it is, because it's so old. It only feels old because you were a baby when it started. So I think that that the nature of what they're allowed to do and the type of company they are, we need to step back and say, well, what kind of company are they? They turn out to be the a new kind of company, a new kind of entity that really is, you know, why they're having dinner at the White House because they're controlling the political discourse of the next election. That's why they're having private dinners at the White House. So my first tweet was when Mark Zuckerberg said that privacy was a thing of the past. And I learned how to use Twitter so I could tweet that. I could tweet he was wrong. And then my most recent tweet was when he said he was not going to – he didn't care about truth and political advertising. And I'm not a big tweeter. But I tweeted again, Mark, again, you don't know, that's not right. You need to have truth on Facebook and political advertising. I mean, he's a – he's – 80% of Americans get their news from Facebook. So he doesn't care about privacy and he doesn't care about truth. That's not good. So we need to say, well, what exactly is Facebook, and begin to regulate it, not in a punitive sense like you would, you know, break it up into little pieces. It's too big. It's not about how it's big. It's about what it sees itself as and what its rules are. And I think this is a discussion that is so profound because a company, you know, both its algorithms that are pushing people to the right and to the left and are pushing people to kind of exacerbate, you know, hate and discourse and divisiveness. But more than that, a company that's in the political mix that doesn't care about privacy and doesn't care about truth – this cannot be a good thing.
And by the way, a company that is profiting on your data, my data,
yes,
everybody's data, and we sort of accept it as the company's out there. It's always been there. This is the way it functions. So
well,
time
that's
for
what
people.
I mean. Yeah. Well, that's what I mean about we think these companies are grown up,
yeah,
because we grew up with them. That's still a young company. We may be seeing our wrinkles, but that's a young company. So really taking a cool eye and not focusing so much on is it, you know, we're still using models of, well, what's wrong with it? It must be too big. I'm not interested in its size. I'm interested in its social practices that are leading to anti-democratic results. And you simply cannot proudly say, I don't care about privacy. I don't care about truth. But I'm clearly influencing elections all over the world, and particularly our election, and get away with that.
Let's try and let's get one more call into this conversation before our hour is over. Carol is calling from Auburn, Alabama. Carol, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Great program. Great and really important topic. I think we need to just face up to the fact that it's not just the newer social media, but even email and so forth, the impersonality of it that is affecting sense of community, sense of relationships. I was National Secretary of the Sierra Club when we set up our internal email system. It was before the net came up. and was immediately inundated by people calling me and texting, emailing me saying, I don't appreciate the tone of some of the comments I'm getting from people in debates on forest policy and things like this. And it seemed to me that in lacking the face-to-face communication, people felt free to state things in ways that they would never say things face-to-face. I mean, I got copies of emails in which a lawyer in Chicago was calling someone the spawn of Satan for disagreeing with him on forest policy.
Right. Carol, it's a great point. I'm glad you brought it up. John, Carol's talking about human tendencies that I guess are in many of us. And your argument is that social media just somehow, fuels them with nuclear fuel, essentially.
Yeah. No, that's right. I think this is a perfect call to end on. Thank you, Carol, for that, because it gets us away from these systemic changes that need to be done by the platforms, and it brings attention to what each of us can do. And especially here we are the day before Thanksgiving, I think this is a really good opportunity for us to think about how we live in a new world. We live in a world in which it's so easy to start a fire, as it were. It's so easy to add to the outrage out there. And so something that I've been playing around with when I give talks and when I teach classes, as we talk through how social media has changed things, I suggest what I call the anti-outrage pledge. And there's just three simple statements. And I hope maybe listeners will consider whether they would say these or treat this as an aspiration. It's very simple. It's, I will give less offense, I will take less offense, and I will pass on less offense. And the reason why I think it's important is that because things can be taken out of context, because the platforms will ramp up outrage and any misunderstanding can lead to a ridiculous nation. Just the other day, it was somebody tweeted he didn't like Indian food. And so the whole internet was taken up for a day or two with that. This is absurd. So we have to realize that we have to be more careful about what we say because we live in a new world. So we should. I do think we do need to be more sensitive. That is the part of political correctness, which I think I actually agree with. But then we also all have to have thicker skin and not react so much and not pick on every little thing. And that's the part of political correctness which I think is causing problems.
All right. Jonathan Haidt, professor at NY's Stern School of Business and author of the article in the December issue of The Atlantic magazine entitled The Dark Psychology of Social Networks. Thank you, John. Great to have you.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
And Sherry Turkle, professor of the Social Studies of Science and Technology at MIT. Thank you so much for coming in as well. It was
my
great
pleasure.
Having you. Listeners, you can continue this conversation. Get the On Point podcast at onpointradio.org. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. Have a great Thanksgiving.